No, pitäisikö meidän aloittaa?
Jep.
Okay. Hello again, everyone. There seems to be only one student here in the class. Okay, another arrived. But we can begin. It's 15 past 9. Today, I will mostly speak about capital regulation and liquidity regulation. Yesterday, we spoke about systemic importance and this OSI and GSIB capital buffers. There are many other buffers. I will go through them one by one today and also describe the current liquidity regulation. But before that, I speak about the supervision in the euro area. There was a major change in the banking supervision in the euro area because currently the banks in the euro area are supervised by the SSM or the supervisory, single supervisory mechanism. It consists of the ECB and national supervisor. Before the SSM, banks were supervised by national supervisor, but this was changed when the SSM was found in 2014. The SSM is one of the two parts of the banking union. The other part is the single resolution mechanism. The ECB directly supervises the 114 significant banks, most of them locate in the euro area, except that there is one Bulgarian bank among these 114 banks. But mostly this concerns banks in the euro area. Almost all of them are either globally significant institutions or OSIs. But there are other banks among these 114 significant banks. These banks are selected based on criteria. Together, these banks, they hold about 80% of banking assets in the euro area. So the ECB supervises about 80% of the banking sector in terms of assets, even if it directly supervises only one of these 114 banks. National supervisors are the entities that continue to supervise the less significant institutions. The SSM was established during the sovereign debt crisis doesn't have a clear ending date. Some say that it ends in 2013, but that's debatable. But in any case, the SSM was established in 2014. And one of the main objectives of the SSM is to ensure consistent supervision. We had differences between countries in banking supervision, in quality of it before the SSM. The SSM was found to ensure that the supervision in the euro area is consistent. The ECB is the one who oversees banking supervision. But also, I already mentioned that there is one Bulgarian bank among these 114 banks, because also countries outside the euro area are allowed to join the SSM. I think the exact phrasing is something like that they are allowed to enter into close cooperation with the ECB. Because the ECB, of course, does not have any kind of power outside the euro area. If you are wondering what are those pink countries there, they are Kosovo and Montenegro. They are pink because they are euro countries in a sense that they use euro as their official currency, even if they are not members of the euro area. They are kind of free riders in the system. I guess no one wants to stop that. Small countries, probably they cannot afford their own monetary system, so they use euro. And Croatia and Bulgaria that joined the banking union 1 year ago, they are the first countries to join the banking union outside the euro area. Probably you have heard this Basel III regulatory, have heard of Basel regulatory framework many times before, right? It was preceded by Basel II, which was very logically preceded by Basel I. Today we have Basel III. The objectives of this Basel I were to strengthen the soundness and stability of the international banking system and diminish competitive inequality among international banks. Before the Basel I banking regulation, was different in different jurisdictions. They had, because the objective is to diminish competitive inequality among international banks. Banks that were operating in many countries had different supervision and different regulation in different countries. The second objective of Basel I was to diminish this competitive inequality. Banks are regulated because they are characteristic to operate on very low equity ratios, which means that they have high leverage, because banks fund their assets mostly from deposits. They have only some investor funds, and compared to many other industries, a large share of bank assets is funded from liabilities. For example, if we have an industrial company, it's not even rare that they have 50% of equity. That their equity ratio is 50% to total assets. But that is very rare for banks. Only some very specialized banks may have that high equity ratios. Usually it's closer to 10%. And by far the biggest single component of bank liabilities is customer deposits. Even though there are differences, some banks fund their assets using debt instruments and so on. Well, this is data from Bank Focus. Here in the JSBE, we have access to this excellent database called Bank Focus. If you want to use it in your project works or thesis, it's very much encouraged. I downloaded data on Western European banks and I drew a figure on bank funding. This has several components. Blue color is equity, red color is interbank deposits, and green color, red color is customer deposits, and then there is this yellow or orange yellow, it's long-term liabilities. As you can see, the mean equity ratio is about 13%. The median is closer to 9%. Banks don't have that much equity. They use other liabilities for funding their assets. And easily, it's very visible that the biggest component of bank funding is customer deposits. It's more than half on average of bank liabilities. And as you can see, none of the bars reach 100%. This is because there is something missing. Banks also use other instruments than these four, but quite close. It's about 90-95%, something like that, of bank funding is on average explained by these four components. So because banks have very low equity ratios, even relatively small losses could bankrupt banks. Because if they have an equity ratio of 10%, they only need to lose 10% of their assets and all their equity is gone. So bank capital is needed to absorb losses. And among other things, banks are regulated and supervised to protect depositors and to prevent bank runs. Well, here is an example This is from the publication called The Banking Crisis in Iceland. Yesterday, I mentioned briefly that in Europe, we had several systemic banking crises during the financial crisis. And one of them was Iceland. At least here in the Northern Europe, this Icelandic banking crisis gained quite a lot of attention. Well, you can conclude the reason for this banking crisis very well. It's a very small country, but it still had a quite colossal banking sector. You see that the asset growth, it begins somewhere around 2004-2005 and ends from 2008, where the size of the banking sector relative to the gross domestic products, it's all over 10 times. I mean, it's almost 10 times the size of their national product. So Icelandic banks, they used internet to collect deposits abroad. They had many customers in the UK and so on. And when the economic decline began, they made losses, and the losses were so big that they couldn't meet their liabilities. And because even the sovereign couldn't save us because the banking sector was so enormous compared to their economy. So most of these Icelandic commercial banks bankrupted during the crisis. Some savings banks survived. There was quite dramatic things that happened during this crisis. The government of UK, it froze assets of some of these Icelandic banks using terrorism laws. Probably that's illegal, but they didn't mind. So it's a kind of scary, really. These capital requirements were risk-weighted already in the Basel I. They are risk-weighted in Basel III and were risk-weighted also in Basel II. Risky assets are required to have more capital, and some assets need less capital. For example, cash is risk-free. There's no reason. There's absolutely no reason to have any capital for that. But for example, corporate loans or consumption loans are, generally speaking, very risky. Banks need to have more capital for them. A large capital buffer, it implies a better loss absorption ability. If there are losses, banks simply have more capital to absorb the hit. This protects the depositors and creditors of the bank. And the EQD is divided, well, roughly speaking, it's divided to three categories according to the quality of capital. The highest quality is common EQD tier 1 or CET 1. Mostly it is investors' money, it is common shares and returned earnings. There are some other instruments in this, but mostly this is all about investors' money. Then the second highest level is additional tier 1. Well, this is also perpetual. They have no maturity dates, even though they may have some call options in it. But how I approach this additional tier 1 is that there is equity of lower quality, but that does not have any kind of maturity date. And what comes to this equity of the lowest quality, tier 2, it may have maturity dates, even though the minimum maturity is 5 years. But what is common for all of these EQD types is that they all have to be paid in. They are not options or anything similar. All have to be issued and paid in. This goes very detailed and this goes very accounting. There is a quite detailed list of these in this Basel publication. And in the Basel III, the required minimum capital ratio, it's 8% to risk-weighted assets. Or precisely, banks need to have 4.5% of risk-weighted assets. I mean, common equity tier one ratio has to be at least 4.5%. And then banks can have 1.5% of this additional tier one capital and 2% of this lowest quality tier two capital, even though they can meet this minimum requirement holding only tier one equity, because capital of higher quality can always be used instead of capital of lower quality. But in any case, it has to be at least 8%. And if banks do not meet this requirement, there will be immediate consequences, beginning from restrictions to profit distributions. And the most severe consequence is that they may lose their banking license, even though that doesn't happen very easily. These risk weights can be calculated using two methodologies: standardized approach and internal ratings-based approach. This standardized approach is from the handbook, and this internal ratings-based approach uses banks' own estimates for loss given default and probability of default. And supervisory approval is needed for the IRB. In the standardized approach, national regulators may allow for using credit ratings in calculating capital requirements. And the risk weight, they depend on the type of exposure. For example, is the exposure to sovereigns or to corporate, to banks, to retail, real estate consumption, or anything? As an example, here is a risk weight table for corporate exposures. As you can see, if the issuing corporation has a high credit rating, AAA to AA minus, the risk weight, it's only 20%. But if it's below BB minus, I mean, if it's a junk bond, then the risk weight is 150%. If it's unrated, then it's simply 100%. And banks need to have equity 8% of this risk-weighted assets. It's just a simple mathematics calculated from this table. But as you can see, the risk weight very much matters for the amount of equity that banks need to have. But banks may also, instead of using credit ratings, banks may rely on their own internal estimates of risk components. Only some of the biggest banks use this, and most of them use this only for some assets in their portfolio. They need to estimate things like probability of default and loss given defaults. And there are conditions. The supervisor and regulators, they are quite strict about this. They have minimum requirements for using this internal ratings-based approach. And it's 47 pages long publication. It's quite technical. It's not easy to get to use this approach. And that's why only some of the largest banks use this. The objective, very simply, is to get more accurate risk weights compared to those of credit ratings. So that was the risk-weighted capital ratio. But besides this, the Basel III introduced another minimum capital ratio, the leverage ratio, which is to supplement the risk-weighted capital ratio. This leverage ratio, well, basically it is the capital ratio, but without risk weight. The idea is that banks are not allowed to build a massive leverage, even if they meet the minimum capital requirement of 8%. For example, if a bank has tons of some very low risk exposures or assets at least on paper, they can build a massive leverage. The objective of this leverage ratio is to prevent banks from building this leverage, even if they meet the minimum requirement. Banks need to have at least 3% of Tier 1 equity relative to total exposures. These total exposures, it includes all the bank's assets and all the off-balance sheet exposures. But this 3%, it's not very restricting. All the banks need this. And the objective of this leverage ratio is simply to prevent some banks building this excessive leverage. This was first published in 2009. That is, well, during the financial crisis. They didn't have anything like this during the financial crisis. So this is based on the lessons learned during the financial turmoil in 2007 and 2009. And also the Basel III introduced a buffer called capital conservation buffer. This is, well, shortly it's CCOB. This is designed to protect a bank's minimum capital. The CCOB buffer is 2.5% of risk-weighted assets, and it is added on top of the minimum requirements. This buffer is collected during an economic boom, and it's released in an economic decline. In the euro area, it is the ECB that makes the decision when to release the buffer. And during the corona crisis, the ECB actually allowed euro area banks to breach the CCOB buffer. And this is mandatory for all banks. It's not bank specific. This is the answer to one of the problems during the financial crisis, because just in the eve of the financial crisis, banks, they were able to meet the minimum requirement, but they very barely had any kind of voluntary buffer above the minimum requirement, which led to problems in solvency when the economy declined. But this requirement requires banks to collect a buffer to protect the minimum capital buffer. They are allowed to breach this when the crisis hits. So if banks meet this before the crisis or during period of economic growth, it's meant for the future. If they don't meet this requirement during periods of economic decline, it's okay if it's approved by the ECB. This is just to protect the minimum capital. And then on top of these that are mandatory for all banks, national supervisors also have power to give banks capital requirements. This is called Pillar 2 requirement, and it is based on the process called supervisory review process, which means that the supervisors go through banks, bank by bank, and decide whether they need some extra equity to take account of the risks that are not covered by the minimum, that is the Pillar 1 requirements. The national regulators may decide that there are some risks in some banks that are not covered by these minimum requirements. It is not rare that larger banks have some kind of a Pillar 2 requirements. I will return to this a little bit later, yes. But now will I speak for a moment about bank liquidity. I will return to capital a little bit later. But since banks transform liquid deposits into illiquid loans, they are by definition exposed to liquidity risk. Banks may not be able to convert loans to cash when necessary. This is a textbook example of liquidity risk. And a bank run, it's a very much classic example of a liquidity crisis. Bank run, it means, well, you have heard this many times before. Bank run means that people, they withdraw their deposits from a bank. And as a result, bank loses so much of its liabilities that it cannot function anymore. This have happened during centuries and during decades. Some people argue that the modern deposit guarantee schemes have made the bank runs obsolete, but I don't agree with that, because this have happened during the 2000s. There was a bank run in the UK. We had a bank run. Well, this photo on the right, this is from Cyprus from 2013. People withdrew their savings from local banks. Even though during the financial crisis, the liquidity crisis was not caused by the classic bank run, people withdrawing their savings, it was caused by a crisis in the interbank markets. These interbank markets froze after the collapse of this Lehman Brothers bank. There was a distrust in the interbank markets. Participants didn't trust the repaying ability of other participants. That is why markets froze, and banks that were dependent on lending money from the interbank markets, they couldn't roll their debt because the market froze. Well, here is a figure I drew using bank scope data. Well, this depicts very visibly the liquidity crisis. This is a graph of the liquid asset to total assets ratio. Liquid assets, they include cash and interbank deposits interbank loans and level one assets. As you can see, there is a very clear dip in the liquidity ratio. The banks recover mostly because of the easing, quantitative easing made by the ECB. But this is an example of a modern liquidity crisis got by trouble in the interbank markets. And as a response to this liquidity crunch, that is to this very much visible dip, two ratios regulating bank liquidity were introduced in the Basel III. These are the liquidity coverage ratio, or LCR, and the net stable funding ratio, or the NSFR. Both of these regulate liquidity, but just in a different way. The LCR requires banks to hold a stock of high-quality liquid assets. For example, cash. Cash is very high-quality liquid asset because it's already liquid. And this stock has to be sufficiently large for banks to manage the net cash outflows for the next 30 days. This is a short-term liquidity ratio. It's designed to collect a buffer that keeps the banks running for the next month. This was published in 2013. That is a few years after the financial crisis. And these assets that are included in this high quality liquid assets are assets that can be easily and immediately converted into cash at little or no loss of value. Well, cash, it's already cash. Of course, it's a high quality liquid assets. Also, central bank reserves are included, and some securities that claims that represent claims on sovereigns, central banks, and so on. That is that are of a high quality. Assets that are issued by other banks are not included. This is a very important clause in this regulation. Well, here is the ratio. We have the stock of high quality liquid assets. Then as the denominator, we have total net cash outflows over the next 30 calendar days. You can think this as a buffer of cash, because that is what it is. It has a link to everyday life, because we all have a buffer of cash just in case we need something. The idea is the same. This is to ensure that banks have a buffer of cash to survive the next 30 calendar days, even if they lose all their links with their liquidity sources. Which this raises the questions that why didn't have anything like this before? Why didn't we regulate liquidity before the financial crisis? It was regulated in the UK. They had a regulation. In France, they had a regulation, and also in the Netherlands, they had a regulation. This LCR, it's almost a direct copy of the regulation. In France, they call it the liquidity coefficient. It was slightly changed and applied to the whole euro area. And also before the introduction of the LCR, there were liquidity. Well, we had central bank liquidity. Maybe they assumed that it is enough to cover the liquidity needs even during the financial turmoil. We have these deposit insurance schemes. Maybe they thought that they are enough to prevent the bank runs like they usually are. So maybe they simply were not aware of the threats that this interbank market can freeze and cause a liquidity crisis. Very specific data is needed to construct this LCR, and especially there is no variable for net cash outflows. Maybe even banks don't have, they estimate these outflows, or maybe they use historic data. But if you go to any commercial database, for example, this Bank Focus, there is no variable for net cash outflows. Therefore, it is very difficult to do any kind of research on this variable. Cash to asset ratio, it's sometimes used as a proxy variable, and also liquid asset to total asset ratio is also used. For example, I and Juha have published a study where we use this liquid asset to total asset ratio as a proxy variable for this LCR. And then this net stable funding ratio, or the NSFR, it concerns the maturity mismatches between assets and liabilities. This promotes funding stability. This also regulates liquidity, but just in a different way than the liquidity coverage ratio. That was a short-term liquidity ratio, but this is a long-term kind of a structural liquidity ratio. Illiquid assets have to be funded from illiquid liabilities. For example, if we have illiquid assets such as loans or mortgages, they have to be funded from liabilities that are equally stable or equally illiquid. For example, equity is considered to be very, very illiquid or very stable. The banks have to match their required stable one funding with available stable funding. This results as the net stable funding ratio, that is the requirement. That is, if you have assets that are liquid, you can use short-term liabilities such as some kind of immediately withdrawable deposits to fund them. But if you have a long-term, if you have an illiquid asset, such as a mortgage or a loan, you need to have some kind of a longer term liabilities for them. This was published in 2014, just 1 year after the publication on the LCR was published. And as the name implies, available stable funding consists of stable bank funding. These stable items have higher weights. Equity, well, it has a coefficient of 100% because it's investors' money. Customer deposits also have a high coefficient, 90%, even though they can be withdrawn from the banks. But in reality, people very rarely do that. And during financial crisis, actually, customer deposits may even increase in banks. And long-term liabilities that have a maturity of at least 1 year, they have a coefficient of 100%. That is, they are fully included in this stable funding. But what is important is that interbank deposits have a weight of 0%. They are not considered stable because bank withdraws them so easily. Well, here is another figure about bank funding, just that the sample period is... Nope, this is the same figure, sorry. But what is different is that now I have calculated the average value for interbank deposit to total asset ratio. It's about 15%. It is quite high. About 1/6 of bank liabilities consists of interbank deposits. But as you can see, the green bar from 2010, it's visibly bigger than is the green bar from 2019. The share of these interbank deposits decreases quite a lot during the sample period. This is a process that started even before the financial crisis, because banks themselves, they realized that it's not a stable source of funding. So they began to replace it by these customer deposits that are the very much classic way to fund a bank. And as for the required stable funding, it is calculated using the same principle as the available stable funding. That is, balance sheet items get weights according to their liquidity risk. Again, cash is considered to be risk-free because it is already cash. Mortgages have a quite high coefficient. Physical commodities have a quite high commodities. There are plenty of categories for this. These are all listed in this publication by the Basel Committee. But for example, assets that are used as collaterals that are encumbered, they have a weight of 100%. But what we have as a result is a ratio that's net stable funding ratio. That is the ratio of available stable funding to required stable funding. And it has to be at least 100%. That is, for every cent of required stable funding, banks need to have a cent of available stable funding. It's very difficult to, maybe even more difficult to study this NFSR than it is to study the LCR, because very specific data is also needed for this ratio. The loan to deposit ratio can be used as a proxy variable. I've seen studies doing exactly that, at least with some accuracy, maybe a partial. Well, personally, maybe a good proxy for that. There was a study, a review, where this author King argued that many banks will experience problems in meeting this minimum requirement. That is probably true, because we had banks that were specialized in operating in in interbank markets. How did they solve this problem? How did they change the structure of the liabilities to meet these requirements? Probably they increased using debt securities, long-term liabilities in their funding. Or this is at least what this King argues, that probably it is the most cost-effective way to answer this requirement. And I already mentioned that banks, they began to shift funding away from wholesale funding or interbank funding already before the NSFR was introduced. But this is not to say that this ratio gave no incentives, because it does. And it became a minimum standard by 1st of January 2018. But I haven't found any published studies on the development. Probably this is because of the lack of data. Would be interesting to see that what kind of banks experienced problems in meeting this requirement. But this is from an ECB, from the ECB's publication, Financial Integration and Structure in the Euro Area. When the blue bar is the year 2008, then there is 2016. It's the orange bar or the yellow bar. Then the orange bar is the year 2018. There is the second group of bars shows wholesale market funding, that is interbank market funding. As you can see, the bar for the 2008, it's quite high. It's 35% almost. And the bar is much lower during 2008. Banks have reduced using this type of funding very much. It's the difference is very much visible. And as for deposits, the leftmost group of bar shows the household and corporate deposits. The blue bar is much lower than the orange bar. That is, banks have moved towards a much more traditional funding model or banking model. They use customer deposits to fund their assets and less wholesale funding. Also, the share of equity has increased. The blue bar, it is lower than the orange bar. And besides strengthening capital and liquidity, the Basel III also has other objectives. It wants to protect the banking sector from periods of excessive growth. And it wants to promote more forward-looking loan loss provisions. For this first objective, well, it partially overlaps with the first objective. I return to capital for a moment, because the Basel III includes the counter-cyclical capital buffer, or CCYB. This is a time-varying capital buffer. All the rest of those capital buffers, well, maybe excluding the capital conservation buffer, they do not vary over time. The CCYB aims to ensure that capital requirements take account of the macro financial environment. This is supposed to be collected during economic booms, and it's supposed to be released in an during periods of economic decline. There is a benchmark how to match the timing. It uses credit to GDP as a variable, and especially the deviation of the credit to GDP ratio from its trend can serve as a common starting reference point for taking buffer decisions. This was published immediately after the financial crisis in 2010. The idea, I'd say, it's very simple. Banks collect buffers during good times and release them in bad times. Just is that the obvious problem with this is that the timing of the release is difficult. But this buffer, it helps banks to absorb losses during crisis. and it reduces the risk of constrained credit supply during financial crisis. And also it may slow down the build-up of excess credit. That is why the credit cycle is used as a variable for this buffer, I mean, for the buffer decision. Well, here is a variable that I found from the database provided by the World Bank. This is domestic credit to private sector as a ratio to GDP, and the scale or the scope of this variable is the world. That is, this measures all credit to private sector in relative to world GDP. Well, as you can see, there is cyclicality in this variable. Well, there is a peak at the beginning in the turn of the millennium. Then the credit growth, it kind of slows down. The ratio is much lower during the 2000. It begins to increase again during the 2010s. And during the corona crisis, it increases quite rapidly, probably because of this massive public sector programs that we have had. And also maybe the world GDP also declines during the corona crisis. So the kind of the both the numerator and denominator affect this ratio. Well, these are a bit difficult to interpret. These are copied from the publication by the Basel Committee, that is from this guidance for national authorities operating the countercyclical capital buffers. This is about the timing when to release the capital buffer. This vertical line, the black line, well, it marks a systemic banking crisis. Then this red line, it is the credit to GDP ratio, and the green line is the gap, that is the Basel gap, which is the deviation of this ratio from its long-term trend. If the green line is very high, it should be kind of an alarm signal when to release this CCYB buffer. Well, as you can see, sometimes this credit to GDP ratio actually manages in predicting a systemic banking crisis. Sometimes it does not. For example, there is United Kingdom in 1990. The turn in the green line, it exactly matches the systemic banking crisis. Usually it comes with a slight delay. The ratio decreases, I mean, the gap decreases, and the systemic banking crisis follows. But this is not a regulation. This is just something that the Basel Committee proposes that the national supervisors may use as a guidance. If we want to use some other variables to predict the correct timing, they are allowed to do so. Well, here is an example. It is the same variable, domestic credit to private sector of GDP, but the country is Ireland instead of the world. Again, there is a quite clear cycle. This begins from 2001. During just before the financial crisis, the ratio is very high and begins a quite constant and quite rapid decline during the 2010s. Well, again, probably this deviation of the ratio from its long-run trend, maybe it would have predicted the correct timing when to release the CCYB buffer in Ireland. But they didn't have those because this was introduced in 2010. So Ireland didn't have this back then when they had their financial crisis. Okay, so quite a lot of buffers. We have the Pillar 1 requirement, that is the minimum capital requirement. Then we have the Pillar 2 requirement, that is the bank-specific requirement that the national supervisors may require banks to collect. Then we have the capital conservation buffer that is mandatory for all banks. It's the buffer of 2.5 percentage points. Then we have the systemic risk buffers, for example, G-SIB buffers and O-SII buffers. And we have this, finally have this CCYB or countercyclical capital buffer. This is what I found from a publication called Presentation for Fixed Income Investors. The example bank is Santander, and this shows their regulatory capital requirements for June 2021. As you can see, there is this minimum requirement of Tier 1 equity. It's the 4.5%. On top of that, the Santander seems to have a Pillar 2 requirement of 0.84%. This is something that has been decided by the Bank of Spain. Then there is the mandatory capital conservation buffer. Then they have a G-SIB buffer that is 1 percentage point. Then, related to the Pillar 1 requirements, they have additional Tier 1 requirement of 1.78 percentage points. And on top of that, they need 2.38% of Tier 2 equity. So everything counted together, the capital requirement for Santander, it's about 13% of risk-weighted assets. And as you can see, they meet this quite easily. They have 12.1% of Tier 1 equity and 1.5% of additional Tier 1 equity. So they could meet this capital requirement only using their Tier 1 equity. But on top of those, they have about 2.2% of Tier 2 equity. And in cold numbers, they have equity, it's about 95 billion euros. Here is the same figure from June of 2020. As you can see, the requirement has barely changed. There is a change in the CCYB, countercyclical capital buffer. It has increased by a meaningless amount, 0.01%. Other than that, the requirements have been, I mean, the requirements are the same. But seems that they have lost, I mean, relative to risk-weighted assets, they have increased capital a little bit. Oh, sorry, I mean, it has decreased. Sorry, it's CCYB has decreased in 2021 by a meaningless amount. This is the figure from 2020. So practically, there are no changes during this year. But in any case, the ratios are quite stable. There is a slight increase in the capital ratio of Santander from 15.5 to 15.8, but the amount of total equity increases about 4 billion. Well, here are more figures. This is this bar. Oh, wait a moment. Capital requirements for a sample of example banks. This is now 1st of January. Sorry. 1st of January 2020. This is before the corona crisis. Well, quite a lot of buffers again. As you can see, the Pillar 1 requirements are the same for all the banks. What are different is the Pillar 2 requirements, except that all of these example banks have these. And for example, for UniCredit, this requirement is far from small because it's 2 percentage points. Also, there are differences in the countercyclical capital buffer because Santander, UniCredit barely have any requirements. It's just a fraction of a percent. But in Nordea, it has a countercyclical capital buffer of 1.4%. And this is because the CCYB buffer is very high in Norway and in Sweden, but for some reason it's zero in Finland. Probably this is, or maybe this is just a guess, maybe it is because Swedes have become quite indebted. Credit growth in Sweden and also in Norway has been faster than in Finland. So maybe the supervisor sees that that banks in Sweden and in Norway, they need to prepare for future losses because of this excess credit growth. Nothing wrong with this idea because this is exactly what the CCYB is designed for. And the total CET1 or the Tier 1 requirement, it is the highest for Nordea. And it's quite a lot. It's more than, well, it's about 3.5 percentage points higher than that of Santander. It is explained by the CCYB and partially by differences in the systemic risk buffer. It's 3%. Yes, it seems that I'm missing a slide. This SRB, it's systemic risk buffer. It is one of the 3 systemic risk buffers, and the other are OSI buffer and G-SIB buffer, and the highest of these 3 applies. The supervisor, it is the national supervisor that may consider using this systemic risk buffer if the national supervisor thinks that the G-SIB buffer or the OSI buffer does not account for all the systemic risks that this bank has. The highest systemic risk buffer is 3%. As you can see, the systemic risk buffer for Nordea is 3%. Their OSI buffer is 2%, but the supervisor has thought that this OSI buffer of 2% is not enough to cover the systemic risks of Nordea, maybe because Nordea is so big in Nordic countries. So it requires Nordea to collect a buffer of 3% systemic risk buffer. And as a result, the CET1 requirement for Nordea, it's substantially higher than for these two other example banks. As for the total capital ratio, the difference between Nordea and Santander, it's even bigger. It's more than 5 percentage points. And these are the requirements from the 1st of April 2020. That is just a moment after the corona crisis began. If there has been a decrease in the ratio, it is marked by the red number. If the ratio, the requirement has been stable, the number is just black. As you can see, the regulation for Nordea, it very much responded to the crisis. They decreased this Pillar 1 requirement and they removed, I have made a mistake. There should be minus 3% next to this SRB because this SRB or systemic risk buffer, it was released by the regulator, and the CCYB buffer or the countercyclical capital buffer, it decreased by 1.2 percentage points. And as a result, total capital requirement for Nordea, it decreased by 3 percentage points during the corona crisis. As you can see, for the two other example banks, Santander and UniCredit, the decreases are much smaller. It's about 0.2% for both of these banks, which raises questions. Since we have these instruments that should react to turns in business cycles, why some jurisdictions do not use them, and why some do? Is there something different between the countries, or is it caused by something in the risk profile of Nordea, Santander, and UniCredit? These are big questions. Sometimes these banks actually may disclose why they are required to have some kind of a buffer. But if they are not required to have some kind of buffer, they never tell that we don't have, for example, we don't have systemic risk buffer because of this and that. So just reading these final publications by banks, I'm not able to find the reasoning why Nordea has a countercyclical capital buffer and why Santander and UniCredit do not. And what makes the difference? Why systemically Nordea is considered to be more significant than Santander in their jurisdictions? Well, maybe there actually is a reason, because Nordea in Finland, it's maybe bigger than Santander. Santander in Spain, or UniCredit in Italy. Our markets are so small that our players are relatively bigger here than they are there, even if these banks are much bigger than Nordea. And finally, about loan loss provisions. These are funds that banks allocate for loan losses. It's an item in a bank's income statement. These loan loss provisions, they are a flow variable, and they accumulate as loan loss reserves that are a stock variable that is reported on the balance sheet. Then there's the third phase, is a charge off, when the kind of this bad loan losses, they are charged off the balance sheet, they are deleted and gone, except that there is a fourth phase. They may be reversal of loan loss provisions if the estimated losses are larger than they actually were. Banks may return loan loss provisions. It's not rare to have, if you have a large sample of banks, it's not rare to have negative loan loss provisions. Even if it's a cost item on income statement, it may be negative, because banks reverse this from loan loss reserves. But the Basel III has an objective to make these loan loss provisions more forward-looking. They increase very rapidly in the financial crisis, and as a result, also bank profitability fluctuates. In the former regulation, it is called the IAS 39 accounting standard. It required banks to have so-called objective evidence for loan losses. In this IAS 39, loan loss provisions, they were allocated for loan losses that were already identified. This is called incurred loss approach. And the Basel Committee wants to get rid of this approach and replace it by the expected loss approach. The objective is to improve the usefulness and relevance of financial reporting. Banks estimate their near future losses and allocate provisions for those. They kind of look forward for their losses instead of finding objective evidence for loan losses that already are identified. During the financial crisis, banks, they published, as they were required to, financial information that already was obsolete when they were released. This is what Basel wants to change. They want to banks to look forward for their losses and account these loan loss provisions for these estimated losses. But they knew this when they were designing this IAS 39 accounting standard, but it had the objective to prevent earnings morphing. Earnings morphing means that banks, they overestimate or underestimate their losses and use these reserves to hide profits or hide losses. It's called earnings morphing, and it distorts the information, the financial information reported. This is the objective of the IAS 39, was to get rid of this earnings smoothing, and it actually succeeded in reducing earnings smoothing in banks. So probably, or maybe, we will see. I'm pretty sure that we will get studies on earnings smoothing in the future when banks have reported enough of this loan loss provisions using expected loss approach. Whether this actually increases earnings smoothing again in banks is possible, because they don't have to be anymore allocated for already identified loan losses. Okay, I conclude now. Quite a lot of stuff today. Capital regulation, Pillar 1 minimum requirement that all banks have to be. I have to meet Pillar 2 requirement, the bank-specific requirements given by the national regulation, the capital conservation buffer designed to protect the minimum requirements. It's mandatory for all banks. Yesterday, we spoke about systemic importance. We have G-SIB buffer, O-SIB buffer, then this bank-specific systemic risk buffer, which is based on the decision by the national supervisor, but also liquidity is regulated. We have two ratios, liquidity coverage ratio, net stable funding ratio. And even on top of that, we have leverage ratio, probably not very restricting. Most of the banks can quite safely meet these requirements. And finally, there was this countercyclical capital buffers. Well, there are complaints. If you read economic magazines, economic journals, probably you have seen bankers complaining about banking regulation. For example, in Finland, Björn Wahlroos is quite famous of complaining. A few weeks ago, he complained about regulation tsunami. Well, partially, he's correct. Regulation has tightened. There is more of it, and maybe it's more accurate and more specific. But this regulation, it's not designed to bully bankers. It's designed to improve financial stability and decrease the likelihood of banking crisis. There has been discussion of streamlining the regulation. I've heard people speaking about this, experts. But even the streamlining handbook or streamlining manual of Basel III, this is 300 pages long. But what we will see in the future, will we see some kind of streamlining of banking regulation? I wouldn't be surprised about it. But in my opinion, what I know about banking regulation, financial regulation, I believe that the designer of the regulation has succeeded in improving the regulation. Well, I always say that we have to wait for the next crisis to see whether this system actually works as it is designed to. Designed to work, we had the corona crisis, but the corona crisis wasn't that devastating for banks. So I think that it really did not function as a test for this banking regulation. Well, you could interpret it in a way that the regulation works because at least the banks were safe. But what follows, what kind of future crisis will we have? And how well this regulation can answer the problems of that crisis? It's something that we cannot predict. there was this manager of the, or the head of the single supervisory mechanism that was a French lady. He was, she was a quite magnificent leader because he kind of invented this whole single supervisory mechanism from nothing. She said that we are better prepared for the next storm. I think that is well said, because we cannot predict the future in many ways. We have fintech companies inventing all kinds of things. We have digital currencies. We have this and we have that. How well this banking regulation fits the future crisis and protects us from financial crisis. That is what we see. This regulation, as I have said for multiple times, it's based on the lessons learned during the financial crisis. For every crisis, probably teaches us something new. As you probably know, the answer of the ECB to the corona crisis, they really haven't made any kind of changes to banking regulation, except that they slightly changed the Pillar 2 requirement. Banks don't have to meet it fully with Tier 1 equity. They can use also additional Tier 1 and Tier 2 equity to meet that. But besides that, there really are no changes in the banking regulation. It is the response of the ECB has been in the quantitative easing. They have this emergency funding program. I'm waiting to get access to the data concerning the 2020. I'm pretty anxious to begin to study the corona crisis and the role of these massive funding programs that of the ECB in bank activity. Well, this is what I have to say. Do you have any questions? Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't mention about, isn't there like this fund that which all banks pay certain amount in case of goes into trouble, and so where it's a euro area and it's involved in the banking union. It's supposed to cover for all the funds that individual households would lose in case the bank collapses.
Deposit guarantee scheme.
Oh, yeah.
You mean that? Yes, well, I cannot give you a precise answer. I have read about it.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure do they already have it, but I've seen discussion on like a joint deposit guarantee scheme. Yeah.
I have another question. Do you think that the investor risk can fully be implemented in this system, or is this system to, we all hope that it doesn't happen, that any bank collapse and the investors lose money, but do you think that this system does not cause any moral hazard at the
banking? Well, probably it's impossible to prevent all moral hazard, but at least this should decrease it. Because, yesterday we spoke about the systemic importance. These frameworks, OSA framework and GC frameworks, are designed to give less incentives for moral hazard. But how do you remove it completely from the banking systems? Because banking systems, they have kind of this protection from the governments. They are aware of it. We cannot very easily let banks to fail. But the regulation, it's designed this too big to fail problem in mind. But will it prevent it completely? So it's very difficult to answer that, yes. Also, besides this single supervisory mechanism, I also mentioned about this single resolution mechanism. It's about that when a bank fails, how do they resolve these banks? It's the other part of the banking union. If a bank fails, how do they, for example, transfer those assets and liabilities to other banks? Maybe that's also important. Important for your question. If there is a giant bank that that should be saved, the single resolution mechanism probably helps in that even if the bank fails, its activities continue, but just in other banks. Yeah. How about online? Anything?
I don't see anything here in the chat room. So probably there are no questions from the two participants. Many thanks, Jari-Mikko, for a very nice and clear presentation here. You obviously are an expert on this, and we have been working together already, so I know that you are following this really actively. So to the students, these lectures of Jari-Mikko, yesterday and today, they will be included to the weekly quiz questions. So you will have the quiz tomorrow from 11 to, you have the time to take that from 11 to 20 p.m. please take a good look at these slides and also these recordings. But other than that, I think it's time to thank you, Jari-Mikko, for a very nice presentation. And I suppose that you are going to play some football after this in Oulu or something like that.
Yes,
it's raining. It's raining. It's raining there. Hopefully you can win the tournament there. Okay, so there are only thanks here in chat. So there's actually no questions here. But... So many thanks to you and see you guys next week in the final lectures. And the material of Olli Pekka Ruuskanen will be given to you on next Monday. Okay, thanks. See you all.